I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Bathroom humor has reached a new low.
What they're known for is a soft serve ice cream served in a squat toilet, and it kind of comes in a swirl inside that squat toilet, which looks pretty realistic.
A toilet-themed restaurant today on the show. The magical life of the Olympia oyster, plus the Ask a Mexican Colonist as a Vietnamese place to try. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're always happy when we can catch up with David Karp, who's at the market every week when he's not running around the world researching fruit, pomology, his specialty. And David, today you want to talk to us about a very, very unique, small, it's a tangerine-type fruit, but it's a seedless quichu. So please describe and tell us what it's like.
This is a primitive form of mandarin that's native to China. When I was there in fall of 2008, I saw these all over the place. They're actually marketing them to Europe as cherry oranges. Of course, they can't send them here, but they originated in China at least like 1,200 years ago in the Tang Dynasty, and they were cited in the Song Dynasty as the finest of all mandarins. But let's describe these a little bit more. Slightly wrinkled skin, medium orange-yellow in color. They're about the size between a cherry and a golf ball, and they peel very, very easily. Quite aromatic, very kid-friendly. Kids love them.
Ooh, I smell them from here.
Almost completely seedless.
Mm-hmm.
These are from Garcia Organic Farms in Duluth in North San Diego County. They're right at the peak of their season right now, from there at least. They're quite aromatic. They're sweet, seedless, tender-fleshed, among the best flavored of all mandarins.
I wouldn't call them sweet. I would say that they have a much more, like you said, aromatic and an intense flavor.
Sweet tart.
Sweet tart, yeah, definitely.
Which is what you're looking for in a good fruit. At least I am. Here I am eating these. That's why you can hear me chewing on these things. So they're at their best from North San Diego County in December and January, basically from areas like that, like the Inland Empire, Riverside, Redlands. Ojai, paradoxically enough, is because it's close to the coast, it gets a maritime influence, and it's the latest citrus-growing area in California, at least the latest commercial citrus-growing area. So they are really just starting to sweeten up in Ojai.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned the word tangerine, and I get asked this all the time. In fact, an inspector came up to a citrus grower I know and said, you can't call these tangerines. These are mandarins. So what is a tangerine? Really, it has no botanical significance at all. Tangerines is a subset of mandarins. It's just a popular word for a type such as the classic dancy Christmas tangerine that was popular from Florida until recently and is still grown to a limited extent in California. They are deep red in color, flat, medium-sized, seedy. And so something that fits that profile, specifically the deep orange color and slightly flat, could best be called a tangerine. Something like this, I definitely would not go out of my way to call that a tangerine. But if you did, I wouldn't get into a knockdown, drag-out fight with you over it.
And as we are at the market today, there are several other forms of mandarins. We have the satsumas, we have clementines, which are real popular now. So these are all coming out. They're all in succession. Wonderfully popular fruit.
Prime citrus season now.
That was David Karp. He, of course, is the expert on all things having to do with fruit, and he's filling us in on some very interesting data about various forms of mandarins. We're happy to have caught up with Chris Tominaga today at the market. He is a chef de cuisine over at Joe's on Abbot Kinney in Venice. He's been there about 6 months, and he's at the market now every week shopping. And Chris, can you maybe inspire us with a recipe that you're shopping for and give us a few pointers on how to cook something at home?
Well, one thing that I saw today down at Weiser Farms was some beautiful sunchokes. I always love the sunchokes.
Let's talk about what those are.
The sunchokes, they also go by Jerusalem artichokes a lot of times. It's a tuber. Not actually related to the artichoke, but it's super delicious, super creamy, and just a great late autumn vegetable to be using.
Some people think they're ginger. They look like ginger almost.
Looks a lot like ginger.
Yeah.
I think I've had some people mistake it for ginger before, but it tastes nothing like ginger.
Right.
So something that I'm doing with sunchokes right now, really, really simple, is a sunchoke risotto. I like to have a little bit of cooked sunchoke and a little bit of raw sunchoke. And what we do is we take just a standard risotto using arborio or carnaroli rice and cook it down to just before it's just a little bit crunchy still. And we add in a sunchoke puree with a little bit of milk and spin it up, cooked up sunchokes, and add it, fold it into the risotto, and It's just really creamy and beautiful. Maybe a little bit of Parmesan. Goes really well with some pancetta. And if you really want it to be rich, you add a little bit of egg yolk. Just really nice right at the end. And a little bit of freshly shaved sunchoke right over the top, and it's great.
How do you cook those pureed sunchokes? You just steam them or boil them or mash them or what?
Cook it in a little bit of milk, maybe some water, mm-hmm. season it with salt, and spin it in your blender.
So basically like you'd prepare like a mashed potato almost.
Almost. Uh-huh. For this, you're just making a puree to fold into your risotto, and it's really delicious.
Any seasonings that go with that?
A little bit of salt. Fresh black pepper actually cracked right over the mm-hmm. top is delicious, but you want to let that sunchoke come out.
And what does a sunchoke taste like? What's the flavor? Can you describe it?
It's very root vegetably, but it's crisp.
It's kind of like an unstarchy potato, but it also has, like you said, a root vegetably essence to it that's hard to describe.
It's kind of like a bright root vegetable, I would say, a fresher root vegetable.
Okay, and do you need to peel them?
You don't need to. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people do. I usually peel them, okay. But I know you don't have to.
And then when you do it on top, you say you fold in the cooked stuff, and then you just shave it on top
really,
like you would
really
a little truffle
thinly.
Or something?
Yeah, like you would a little truffle so that you get this bright, raw flavor, mm-hmm. and it's a little sweeter than the cooked.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
That was Chris Tominaga, who's the chef de cuisine over at Joe's on Abbott Kinney, helping us out with a wonderful seasonal recipe from the farmer's market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can see pictures and find recipes from the market at kcrw.com/goodfood. Each week we shoot video at the market too. You can watch them on the Good Food app for the iPhone or the iPod Touch, or you can just go online to see them at kcrw.com/goodfood. We think of oysters on the half shell or in a creamy chowder, but that's not really giving them their due. Oysters are a fundamental part of an aquatic ecosystem, and one particular oyster, the Olympia, caught the attention of our next guest, Rowan Jacobson.
As you know, a couple of years previously, I had written a book called The Geography of Oysters, which was kind of a love letter to the oysters of the United States, but from a consumer's point of view. And when it was during the research of that book that I really fell in love with the Olympia oyster, partly because it's very rare. It's only found in a few areas still in the Pacific Northwest. Partly because it's this delicious little tiny oyster. It's only about the size of a 50-cent piece, much, much smaller than the other oysters we're used to. But it has this super intense flavor, more flavor than any of the others. And it's just, it's kind of unique. There's no other oyster quite like it out there. And I was fascinated that it was basically gone. It created its own environment. It was as much a part of the Pacific Northwest as the redwoods were. And it's even more endangered now than the redwoods are. So when I heard that a group called the Puget Sound Restoration Fund was mounting an expedition up to this really remote area in British Columbia to find the last pristine beds of these oysters, so I basically said, you know, can I go? Can I go? Please, 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 can I go?
And you got there, and what was there?
Well, we were nervous about what was not going to be there. After many, many hours of travel to get up there by boat, we were worried that the oysters might not still be there.
And were they?
They were. In fact, incredible, just acre after acre of this like beautiful golden carpet of these little oysters.
What is the link between the health of the coastal waters and the decimation of the Olympia oyster?
The Olympia was doing fine until the gold rush, when San Francisco suddenly went from a town of about 1,000 people to, I think, a town of 30,000 people 2 years later and growing. And getting food for all those people was an issue, but one thing they had on hand was the billions of Olympia oysters in San Francisco Bay. So we very quickly over-harvested those oysters and wiped out that population. And then basically San Francisco just kept eating its way north, bay after bay. And anyway, so that was the big thing that did Olympias in originally. Olympias are extremely sensitive to pollution, so pollution in various bays was also a big factor for them.
But as these oyster bays go away, other things are affected besides just the oyster. What else lives in the beds? And I guess what do the beds have to do with the overall health of the coastal ecology?
Well, that's right. Marine ecologists refer to oysters as ecosystem engineers because they're one of the few species that really creates an entire habitat and ecosystem. Oysters are incredibly good at cleaning the water which allows sunlight to penetrate all the way to the bottom of the bay. And when the sunlight hits the bottom of the bay, seagrass can grow. And there are quite a few organisms in the sea that either live in the seagrass beds or live in the oyster beds themselves, or they feed on creatures that live in those beds. So kind of the entire food chain is created from that structure that the oysters and the seagrass creates.
When you went with the people from the Puget Sound Restoration Project and they saw these acres and acres of Olympia oysters, what did it mean for the future?
There are already efforts underway to restore Olympias to Puget Sound and San Francisco Bay and some of the other places that we know they did very well at historically. But there really wasn't a model. Like, what should a healthy Olympia oyster bed look like? We kind of didn't know what to even shoot for in restoration efforts. One of the big mysteries that everyone's hoping that these oysters can solve is, why did these oysters persist when they disappeared everywhere else? What's going on in this one spot in British Columbia that has worked so well for these oysters, and can we recreate that elsewhere?
When you were visiting some of these ancient sites, what did you learn about how some of the cultures used the coastline?
I live on the East Coast, and I'm used to thinking of some of these areas out west as being like big wilderness, untouched by human beings still. And certainly this area, one of the most remote in North America. But as we're out there counting oysters on the beaches and taking various other measurements, I'm working around these semicircular rock walls that suddenly somebody else on the trip points out to me are ancient fish traps. And it turns out that many, many miles of coastline in British Columbia were transformed into clam gardens by early peoples centuries ago. So this environment that is incredibly healthy and incredibly productive has actually been influenced quite a bit by human beings, but influenced in a way that did not destroy it. And really got me thinking differently about the relationship between people and wilderness or what you might want to just call natural areas, that really, rather than separating the two, then walling off places and saying, this is wilderness, don't touch it, and then having other places where people live. What interests me is the way that the interactions between the two can actually be very prosperous.
Ron Jacobson is a wonderful author, the author most recently of The Living Shore, Rediscovering a Lost World. We'll have a link to it, of course, at kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, a taste of Vietnam in the OC. Gustavo Arellano is here, so stay tuned. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. For a while now, we at Good Food have wanted to enlarge our exploration of local restaurants to include areas outside of Los Angeles proper. Gustavo Arellano is food editor for the OC Weekly, and today he's going to peel back the curtain to give us a small bite of Orange County. So what kind of food are you going to torture us with today?
Chicken pho in Little Saigon at a place called Pho Da Cao.
Pho Da Cao. And what kind of pho do they specialize in?
Chicken pho. Nowadays, most people know what pho is, but they always associate it as a beef soup because that's what's the most popular version by far in Vietnam, in Little Saigon. So they know those rich flavors of a broth steeped in a beef bone for 24 hours. But there's also another version, just straightforward chicken pho. And all restaurants in Little Saigon that sell pho usually also sell chicken pho. And the trend for the past couple of years is to sell chicken pho 50% off because I guess not enough people buy it. So there are a couple of places, though, that specialize only in chicken pho, and Pho Da Cao, I think, is one of the best ones because they get their chickens fresh.
Now, what do you mean when you say fresh?
They buy all their chicken from its sister business. It's called the Cow Poultry, and that's a couple of miles away in Midway City. It has one of my all-time favorite signs because it advertises we sell poultry in Vietnamese, English, Spanish, Chinese, and Arabic. So you go to this place, it's all five different languages saying, we sell poultry. So you go in there and they have live chickens there in the cages. They raise them at some farm somewhere out in the Inland Empire. But you get to pick your own chicken. About, what, 15 to 20 minutes later, they prepare the chicken and they give it to you right there, all cut up however you want. And so that's where Pho Da Cao gets their chicken. So you know that this chicken hasn't been in a refrigerator for God knows how long. In a couple of hours, it went from clucking to your stomach.
So what do we find in that bowl?
It's as rich as just beef pho, but the flavors are different. Instead of having the nuance and complexities of beef pho, this is straightforward chicken. The chicken, you could get it with gizzards, you could get it with chicken intestine, you could get it with chicken livers. But for those of you folks who don't like those knotty bits, you could just get straightforward chicken. And they sell it to you in big, huge medallions, almost like scallops. When I see them, they're like scallops, completely lean, white meat, no gristle, no nerves, no fat, just the leanest chicken you can imagine. And the broth itself, it's almost like Campbell's chicken soup, except not as salty. It's a much lighter broth than the beef pho, than the Campbell's chicken soup. And of course, it comes just the noodles and the chicken, and that's it. It's up to you to put in the bean sprouts, to put in the cilantro, to put in that weird Vietnamese herb that tastes like eating aluminum foil. I think they call it sawtooth in English, to put in the hoisin sauce and all the other condiments that you'd like. And also, the great thing with pho da cao, they also give you this dipping sauce. I guess the traditional way to eat chicken pho, you actually order the chicken on the side. You dip the chicken into this little sweet and sour slash spicy sauce, and then you put it into the actual broth, and then you start eating the soup as is.
Yum.
It's good. I'm so used to eating beef pho. When I finally said, oh, I might as well try chicken pho, it was an absolute revelation because it's basically pho. It's still pho, but it's a completely different game than beef pho. Also, anytime I get the flu, I swear, I just go down to Pho Da Cao and just eat a huge bowl of chicken pho. And we're talking about a massive bowl that could serve two. They're selling it to you for $5, and that's a small. The large, I've never dared to try to order the large because there's no way I could possibly eat it.
Is there anything else that you ever order on the menu there?
No. It's a huge list. The great thing about Little Saigon, even the restaurants that specialize in one dish, they still have 100 other dishes there. You could order the great Vietnamese vermicelli noodle salad, Boon. I'm sure that's great. You could order beef. You could order other stuff. But it's like when you go to In-N-Out, you're not going to order a chicken hamburger. So when you go to Pho Da Cao, you're not going to order anything else than chicken pho. That's the reason to go there. If you want something else, some other type of Vietnamese dish, I could tell you other places. But you want chicken pho? Pho Da Cao.
Tell us where it is.
So the name of the restaurant's Pho Da Cao. The address is 15532 Ward Street in the city of Garden Grove. And the phone number is 714-531-2009.
Thank you very much, Gustavo.
Always a pleasure.
Gustavo Arellano is our man in the OC. He's the food editor for the OC Weekly, where he also writes the hysterical Ask a Mexican column. Find all of Gustavo's restaurant recommendations on the Good Food Restaurant Map. It's all on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. A few days ago, I posted a little rant about people who don't show up for their restaurant reservations. It's something that really costs restaurants money, which we can't really afford right now. Some places won't even take reservations anymore because of it. I'd love to hear what you think. Join the conversation on the blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Last week, we talked about the Japanese hot pot, or nabe. A listener left a comment on our site explaining how to season a hot pot and gave us a great recipe for mushroom soup. Find the comment under last week's show. Coming up, a restaurant that encourages you to eat right out of the toilet. Yes, you heard me correctly, the toilet. That's next, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Toilet humor is usually the bailiwick of 8-year-olds. but a Taiwanese-based restaurant chain has moved the toilet from the restroom into the dining room. Sandra Wu is a food writer and contributor to Zester Daily. So what's the name of this place?
It's called Modern Toilet, and it started in Taiwan. I went in October just kind of by chance and was very surprised at what I saw when I went there.
So let's talk about what we encounter when we walk in the restaurant. What does the dining room look like?
So when you walk in, at least in the location that I went to, you know, there's shower heads coming out of the wall. The walls are all tiled. The tables are basically kind of like plastic or glass-covered tubs, and you're sitting on, you know, individual toilet seats whose lids are, you know, painted or you know, printed with different motifs.
So you're sitting on a toilet seat in front of a bathtub.
Basically, yes. Mm-hmm.
What is the food like?
You know, for a place that's named Modern Toilet, it's surprisingly not bad. You know, I went into the restaurant with really low expectations, as you, you know, might imagine. But, you know, things were pretty tasty. I mean, it's no worse than, you know, if you or I went to, you know, a theme restaurant in the United States. You know, it's not the best, but it's pretty decent, actually. I was pretty surprised. I ate my whole meal.
Now, do the thematics continue into the serviceware?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that the food is served on also, you know, looks like, you know, toilet-themed. For instance, what they're known for is a soft-serve ice cream that serves at the end for dessert, and it's served in a squat toilet. So if you've ever, you know, been in certain parts of Asia, you'll, you know, have seen those toilets, and it kind of comes in a swirl inside that squat toilet, which looks pretty realistic. And, you know, some of the other dishes, like their curries, they're served in, you know, a Western toilet bowl. So you have like a bubbling brown concoction, you know, right there in the toilet bowl, which is kind of unappetizing, but, you know, it didn't taste too bad.
I mean, that's what I find really interesting is that I wonder if the food is actually better than it tastes. I mean, because it has to be tasty enough to overcome this.
Its appearances, yes. You know, it was pretty good. I mean, I think they probably had to overcompensate. Otherwise, you know, people would go for the kitsch factor and never really return. But the food is actually not bad.
Wow. So interesting. Now, just even the name just seems like a place guaranteed to make people not want to go. What is it about the Taiwanese personality that was able to create and embrace this sort of place?
Well, I think Taiwanese people, you know, they take a lot of cues from the Japanese. And, you know, in Japan, there's a lot of kind of quirky restaurants that, you know, are similarly kind of strangely themed. I think, you know, a lot of younger Taiwanese people really enjoy going to more quirky and sort of trendy restaurants that may not necessarily be something that most people would want to go to. But I think, you know, just being in a place that is different and entertaining, you know, it appeals to the younger crowd.
While you were there, did you happen to see any older folks who don't patronize hipster thematic restaurants, perhaps blanching at their food or being a little put off?
Actually, we went for lunchtime, so there wasn't as much of a crowd as, you know, if we had gone for dinner. And the people that we sat next to were younger folks. But just, you know, talking to my relatives, you know, my parents, my aunts and uncles, their initial reaction was like, oh, why would you want to go to a place like that? It's so gross, you know, and I think it does cater more towards, you know, the younger crowd. But I think that, you know, older folks would probably go there, too, although it may not be their first choice.
I'm so glad that you introduced us to this wacky new place. Thank you, Sandra.
Oh, you're welcome.
Sandra Wu is a food writer who contributes to Zester Daily. See pictures of Modern Toilet at kcrw.com/goodfood. Talking seriously about eating out of a toilet seems completely backwards. Here's another one for you. Noodle soup for breakfast. Roxanne Weber is an associate editor at Chow.com. She joins me to talk about what breakfast is like around the world. So, Roxanne, in other parts of the globe, does breakfast tend to be just for breakfast, or is it food that's also eaten at other times throughout the day?
Some stuff is sort of interchangeable. Like, you could do a dumpling for a late kind of lunch, like almost brunch like we do, or you might grab it for breakfast or something like noodle soup, you know, somewhere else in the world in Southeast Asia. Maybe you'd grab it on the street in Vietnam, like a nice bowl of pho for breakfast. But a lot of these dishes are so versatile if you just sort of think about them, you know, as like, I don't have to have breakfast just be eggs and toast. You know, if you think like noodle soup, wow, I could put all my leftovers together in the morning and have this quick, tasty, savory breakfast.
What about the idea of using different kinds of sausages, which we love? Do you see that other places in the world too?
Yeah, there's so much variety of, you know, cured meat, basically. One thing that this restaurant in San Francisco makes is a riff on a dish in the Philippines where you do like a garlic fried rice and you top it with a thing called pork tocino, which is like a cured pork. It's not a ground meat, but it still is that sort of cured meat, sweet, savory flavor like a sausage. So there's a lot of different takes on breakfast meat.
And rice, too, is used a lot. I love the idea of fried rice for breakfast with an egg on it.
Oh, yeah. Rice is so versatile, and you find it just used all over the world as a breakfast food. I was reading about this great Malaysian breakfast on Chowhound. People were having a really interesting discussion about a dish that's coconut rice, and you serve it with chicken curry and little dried anchovies and chili and peanuts, and it just sounded so good.
For breakfast?
Yes. And then you get into rice, of course, with Japanese breakfast, and people are way into Japanese breakfast, which, you know, traditionally, you can probably find rice, miso soup, maybe some fish and side dishes like pickled vegetables and natto, which is fermented soybeans. And there was a pretty good review recently of a place just down in Gardena called Fukagawa. And the person who ate there loved the Japanese breakfast. They had sought it out and they were talking about like, there was a raw egg on the plate, you know, in the spread, and they didn't know what to do with it. But their friend knew that you beat it up and you put some soy sauce in and you pour that over the hot rice. And it's so fun to just remember that you can really mix it up and just look to other cultures. And there's so many amazing, great things going on for breakfast.
Does it seem like most cultures start their day with a hot beverage that contains some form of caffeine?
It's pretty consistent that there's a tea or coffee. Sometimes, you know, you see that the tea might be like a mint tea or something, but I guess we just all have that in common. We need a little caffeine to get going.
Well, Roxanne, thank you so much for taking us on a trip of breakfast around the world.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What do you eat for breakfast? Do you eat cereal and toast or cold pizza? Tell me all the gory details about your first meal of the day. Leave a comment at kcrw.com/goodfood. Click on this week's show and scroll on down to leave a comment. Green chili breakfast burritos are really popular in New Mexico. In fact, you can find green chilies in almost everything in that southwestern state. Russ Parsons is with me next to talk chilies. I'm Evan Kleiman, and Good Food will be right back in 1 minute here on KCRW and kcrw.com. Every year here in California, we hear about the Hatch chili harvest. And people around us who are chili heads are going online and ordering their chilies, which sometimes I think is like Coles to Newcastle. But no, these are very special chilies. And here today to talk to us about this unique chili and its cultural context is Russ Parsons, food editor and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
So you actually have a great deal of experience with New Mexico.
I have a great deal of experience and a great affection for New Mexico. I've lived there off and on since 1958. And before I came to Los Angeles, I was the only restaurant critic in the state for 4 years, which meant, God, I ate a lot of chili.
So what is it about Hatch chilies that make them different from other chilies?
We call them Hatch chilies here. It's a green chili. And it's found all up and down the Rio Grande Valley. We call them Hatch chilies because Hatch is kind of the center of the production, you know, kind of the same way Vidalia onions are. The Vidalia County in Georgia is the center of the production of Vidalia onions. But Vidalia onions can come from half of the state of Georgia, and green chilies are found all over New Mexico. And what's really interesting is that the New Mexican green chili it's really, really close to what we find here labeled Anaheim chilies. But Anaheim chilies really, they're kind of like bell peppers. It's like a long, slim bell pepper. In New Mexico, these things have some heat. It's a slightly different variety. And, oh, man, I mean, sometimes you eat these things and it makes your head sweat. They're so hot.
But they also have a lot of flavor.
And the flavor varies. Now, the green chili, the chili is served both green and red. In fact, the New Mexico state question is green or red. The red chili is just the dried, ripe version of the green chili.
And are they always dried? Are they ever fresh?
For about 2 weeks out of the year, you can get fresh red chilies. And it's more of an interesting kind of thing than it is a delicious thing. Usually they're almost always served as chili rellenos. And it's a sweeter chili relleno because the green is more vegetal. You know, it's a kind of, I mean, it's like a green bell pepper kind of taste with a lot of heat laid over it.
They have almost a lemony kind of back taste.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really good description. But when they get red, when they get fully ripe, that's when the different kind of concentrated flavors really come out. And I know people in New Mexico who can blind taste red chili the way wine lovers can blind taste red burgundy. You know, they can taste the chili and they can tell from the flavor of it where it was grown up and down the Rio Grande Valley. I'm not at that level, but there's a town north of Santa Fe called Chimayo, and Chimayo is famous for its red chilies. And the native Chimayo chili, I can really taste that. There's ripe fruit to it, but there's also this really wonderful earthy kind of almost a brick flavor that's just amazing. And it's actually a very interesting story because, you know, all of these different chilies, it's not just a matter of terroir. It's not just a matter of climate and soil, but it's what botanists call land races. And that is that these were small farmers, and they would collect the best fruit from each year, and they would save the seeds and start the next year with the seeds from the best fruit of the last year. So actually, you ended up with slightly different varieties of each of them, even though they kind of all come under the same heading.
Now, what is done with these chilies?
New Mexican food the menu is very limited, but kind of the possibilities are almost infinite because every restaurant is slightly different. So, you know, I mean, a basic New Mexican menu will be enchiladas with either green or red sauce and burritos, and then they'll do hard-shelled tacos. But I think they do hard-shelled tacos mainly for the tourists. And, of course, they'll do chili rellenos, which are the fresh green chilies peeled and then stuffed with cheese and fried and then served in sauce. And there's also a great dish called carne adobada, which is pork meat that's been marinated with red peppers and then braised. The classic New Mexican dish, as far as I'm concerned, is the enchilada. And now a real New Mexican will always order it blue corn tortillas because blue corn it's not just a designer pretty corn. It's the variety that was grown in the Rio Grande Valley. They'll order it flat rather than rolled. And there's a good reason for that because blue corn tortillas are very, very fragile. And so if you try to roll blue corn tortillas, you end up with a mess really, really quickly. So if you just flatten them, it works really well. Cheese You can get meat, you can get chicken, but I think cheese is just kind of, you know, it's just the right combination, and that usually there'll be some white onion diced into it, and then either green or red chili. And different restaurants will say, well, our red is better, or oh, our green is better, and you know, which is hotter? Well, it really depends. You know, it just depends. Red is not hotter than green, although it is sometimes. And then with a fried egg on top of it, which is kind of the interesting twist, because when you break into the egg, the yolk kind of mixes with that chili sauce and makes a really nice, gives it almost like a hollandaise kind of quality.
And it kind of also helps attenuate the spiciness if you get a really hot chili.
You cannot overemphasize the potential for spiciness on these things. Remember that the sauce is basically a chili puree. Whether you're talking the green sauce or the red sauce, there are other things that are added to it, but not very much. When it's a chili sauce, it is a chili sauce. That's all there is to it. I mean, I've had stuff that was so hot that I couldn't eat it.
So now if people want to get these chilies, there are reliable online sources for the frozen chilies that have already been peeled, isn't there?
Well, there are reliable online sources for them, and you can Google them and find them. But the great thing here in Southern California now is that Albertson's grocery stores have them in their freezer section. There's a company in Albuquerque called Bueno Foods, and they have frozen peeled chopped green chili, and they have frozen red chili pulp. So that you can go into the supermarket and you can find this amazing chili. I mean, as an expatriate New Mexican, this is like Christmas, which is another New Mexican phrase, because if you absolutely can't make up your mind about what kind of chili sauce you want, you ask for Christmas.
That's
because
perfect.
It's green and red. And green. And it's also Christmas because you get both chilies at the same time.
Thank you so much, Russ.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Russ Parsons is the food editor at the Los Angeles Times, where his section will move from Wednesdays to Thursdays beginning in February. I've got a recipe for green chilies at kcrw.com/goodfood. This is a show about food, so it might not surprise you when I say that we're going to talk about yeast next. But coming up after the break, yeast, not the bread kind. That's next here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm your host, Evan Kleinman. Recently, we received a letter from a listener. She's on an elimination diet trying to combat a systemic yeast imbalance. She wrote that she was having a really hard time finding anything she could eat and asked if we knew of any recipes or suggestions. Well, it just so happens that Marcel Pick has written a book called The Core Balance Diet, which addresses, among other things, yeast imbalance and how to turn it around. Hi, Marcel.
Hi there.
So running the risk of this being too much information, when we think of yeast in the body, most people probably cringe and think, you know, yeast infection. But actually, a yeast imbalance manifests itself in all kinds of ways, right? What are some of the symptoms?
The inclination is for people to think that when they have a yeast problem, they have yeast infections, and that's very few of the people that I see. We normally have yeast in the intestines, but when yeast is actually overgrown, what happens is when it multiplies, it actually has an off-gassing of something similar to formaldehyde, which actually can make us sick. So some people have foggy thinking. Other people might have some gas or some bloating or intestinal complaints. Other people might even have joint pain. But one of the things I hear so often is, I just don't feel well. Of course, there are many things you think of when somebody doesn't feel well, but one of the things to consider if they have complaints of the GI system is also a problem with systemic yeast. Skin rashes, a lot of dandruff, fungus in the toes, fungus in the nails, those are all things that you become suspicious might be actually indicative of yeast.
Now, when I think of yeast or other fungus, I think of a really hard road to getting rid of it. How difficult is it to bring the balance back in line?
The truth is, it's not that hard. I think a lot of people misunderstand the concept that if you have yeast, you have to be on a yeast-free diet for the rest of your lives. Thank goodness that's not true. You do indeed need to change the environment of the intestines. And the way to do that are to stop sugar, to stop malted products, to stop yeasted products. Some of the fermented products actually can make it worse. To use a type of antifungal and an acidophilus, and to really change the environment so the environment is much more conducive to health as opposed to dysfunction and an overgrowth of yeast. I think people feel really discouraged because there are a lot of things you have to eliminate.
Like what?
Vinegar, sweetened products, yeasted products that are yeasted breads, you know, the nice homemade breads that have a lot of yeast in them. You can certainly have things like crackers and things like that, but you have to be mindful that many of the crackers have yeast in them as well. Sugars are things that you need to keep away from your diet. Any of the dried fruits, dates, figs, grapes, prunes, raisins. The other fruits are fine. Some of the yeast-free diets are much more rigid than that, but I find it's too difficult for people to follow. So I say initially when you're on a yeast-free diet, go ahead and have the fruits and vegetables. They're so healthy for you, but stay away from the very concentrated sugars such as the dates, figs, grapes, prunes, and raisins.
Let's talk about what you can eat. What are things that you can just have to your heart's content?
The vegetables you could certainly have, the protein products. Brown rice is fine. Have pastas. Those are fine. But again, for many people, I might be a little bit more mindful as being somewhat careful about the carbohydrate load. But again, it depends on what other health issues they're having. So we're really talking about more of a Mediterranean diet without the olives. So the olive oils are fine. Even I'll have some of my patients use some of the goat and sheep feta cheeses. Generally, we say cheese is not so great because many times you'll have mold on cheeses. That's what makes it so tasty. So you're trying to stay away from the moldy foods as well. But there are so many different recipes that you can use. If you're going to use tomatoes, I usually recommend not to use tomatoes in a can, but to use fresh tomatoes and to make perhaps a salad with that. You get really creative about making a wonderful lemon dressing instead of vinegar because vinegar is one of the things you want to stay away from. So I urge people, if they're going to be doing a yeast-free diet, to have it be yummy. Otherwise, people feel so deprived, and that's what causes them not to be able to stick with it.
Now, what about probiotics? First of all, what does that mean?
Probiotics are the term that's used for the healthy bacteria we have in our intestines. And we have billions of bacteria in our intestines. Some of them we have names for and some we don't. But there's three very important, and I think people have heard of Bifidobacterium or Lactobacillus or something called Escherichia coli. Those are the three very important bacteria that we need to have a lot of in our intestines to help us digest food properly and to help the environment of the intestines be such that they're not going to have an overgrowth of parasites or yeast. Many tests have been done now looking at whether it's a good idea to always be on probiotics, and I'm not a proponent of that. I like to see people on them for probably about 3 months and then take a holiday for 2 months or so because you want the intestines to be able to heal itself and develop its own probiotic.
How long a period of time does it take before we can really get back on track, know that the yeasts are down, and we can sort of feel that we're back in balance? Is it weeks or is it months?
Generally, my rule of thumb is usually a couple of months. And every time that you're being more successful with the dietary protocol and using the antifungal as well as the probiotic and really changing the milieu of the intestines, the more likely is that it's not going to come back. And I have to also say that stress is a component of this because it does change the pH of the intestines as well.
More about probiotics are at kcrw.com/goodfood. A kind of yeast that I love is the kind used to brew beer. In fact, I don't think I can live without it. Christina Perozzi is the beer chick, and she loves beer almost as much as I do.
Well, thank you for having me. It's so good to be here with a fellow beer-drinking chick.
Yes, a fellow beer-drinking chick. So I guess let's start at the beginning. What is craft beer, and how is it different from regular old beer?
Regular old beer. Well, craft beer traditionally has been a type of beer that is made with noble ingredients, made using traditional methods. It's kind of been a way to differentiate good beer from what I call mass-produced industrialized beer. But nowadays, it's just come to be a term, you know, that just means good beer, really. Good tasting, well-balanced, traditional style beer.
And it could be made by a very small microbrewer or, in fact, a much larger company.
It can now. Like, it used to be a term that really differentiated a small brewery that was owned by one person that was in one specific area that only made 15,000 barrels of beer a year. And now that's kind of expanded because there are larger breweries that are making some good, quote-unquote, craft beer.
What are some of those?
Blue Moon by Coors is actually a really decent beer. It's a Belgian-style wheat beer. Not a lot of people know that Coors make it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that Coors makes that
right.
beer.
And you know what? There are a lot of craft beer drinkers that poo-poo any mass-produced industrialized beer and that wouldn't include Blue Moon in the craft beer realm. But I do because I think it's a good first-step beer. It's a good gateway beer to get people into drinking better beers.
It's funny because whenever I go out with people and I'm somewhere where I know I can get really good beer and I could look at a beer menu, whenever I order something and it's poured and the person across from me, of course, is drinking wine, and they're intrigued. And so I'm like, go ahead, taste it. They're like, no, I don't drink beer. No, taste it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's bad. Ooh, beer with good food. Beer in a nice fancy restaurant.
And they take a sip and they're like, that's beer? And I'm like, yeah.
Exactly. Well, you get that all the time. I'm not a beer drinker.
What does that even mean?
It means that they've tried all the beer out there, and that's the beer that they know is out there. It's the ones that they can normally find in their local grocery store that are all the same style. They're all mass-produced industrialized beer, and they're all Pilsner-style beers. And if you don't like a Pilsner-style beer, you're not going to like any of those beers you're going to try. You're going to say, I tried a Budweiser, and I tried a Coors, and I tried a Heineken, and I tried all of these. It's all one style. I don't like a Pilsner-style lager, so I'm apparently not a beer drinker. And it's when you give those people beers, I say, quote-unquote, beers that don't taste like beer, the beers that taste like chocolate, or the beers that taste like citrus, or the beers that have coriander and nutmeg, you know, and you give them one of those beers, and like, oh, this is delicious. This doesn't taste like beer at all.
No, the other stuff.
It's like, no, yes, it does taste like. This is exactly what beer tastes like.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is so much written about pairing wine mm-hmm. with food. Mm-hmm. Is pairing beer that difficult?
I think that pairing beer with food is easier. Just because, first of all, beer has so many more flavors than wine does, such a variety of flavors.
Now, people would be surprised to hear that.
Well, you can have beer. You can have a Rausch beer that tastes like smoke and ham and salts. And you can have an oatmeal stout that tastes like chocolate and coffee grinds. And you can have a Wit beer that tastes like, you know, citrus and pepper and, you know, have a slight sour flavor to it. You can have a Hefeweizen that tastes like bananas and cloves. So when you have all these different flavors, it's a lot easier to pair beer with food. For instance, you know, foods that make a typically difficult wine pairing, like asparagus or mushrooms or tomato sauce or even chocolate and desserts, there is a beer and many beers that pair very well with those kinds of foods.
Well, let's talk about dessert beer.
There are a lot of great beers that go well with dessert. For instance, there's a beer style called Lambic. You know, people consider those to be kind of girly beers because they're sweet. But traditional lambic beers shouldn't be too sweet. They should be both sweet and sour.
And like, sour.
Exactly.
When I give people a taste of those beers, they're like blown away. Because mm-hmm. it's like having a Thai meal in your mouth all at once.
Exactly. And there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's surprising. You know, you get that puckery feeling, but then you get that nice, juicy sweetness, you know, from the fruit. I think it's delicious. And I think doing like a pairing with that, having like a cherry lambic as the sauce for a cheesecake, I think is really interesting. And then, you know, I've talked about the chocolate and coffee beers already, but those are delicious with chocolate, but they're also delicious with vanilla ice cream. Like we've been doing, like, for instance, the Golden State in Los Angeles does beer floats.
I love those.
Yeah. They do amazing things because they have Scoops right next to them, which is a great ice cream place, gelato place, and they'll do really interesting things. They'll do like a Berliner Weiss super sour ale with like a lime gelato. I know I'm not saying it exactly correctly, but they do really interesting flavors. And then, for instance, one time I did a beer float with Unibrew Calcachose, which is a cherry ale with a cinnamon gelato. It's just delicious. You can mix all those flavors, and it's just interesting.
Wow.
And fun, and, you know, puts a little spin on the root beer float.
It's really good. What about the beers that that are aged in like casks, bourbon casks, for example?
That's a I don't want to say trend. I hate that word because I don't want it to end. But a lot of brewers now, and it has been a traditional thing in the past, to actually either ferment their beer or age their beer in oak barrels that they either get from winemakers. You know, maybe they'll do a Pinot Noir barrel. Maybe they'll do Zinfandel barrels. Or maybe they'll, like, for instance, Allagash out of Maine has a beer called Curieux, and they age the beer in Jim Beam barrels. So...
And that is a really interesting beer because the nose is, you smell that bourbon.
Yeah, you get it. You get the bourbon in the nose and you also get it in the exhaust and the heat of it. But you don't get that slap in the face sometimes that you can get from bourbon. It's just a really nice, warm, delicious beer. And actually, that's a beer that I'll have for dessert as well. Kind of like that play on a whiskey at the end of a meal.
Thank you very much, Christina.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Christina Perozzi is also known as the Beer Chick. Her latest book is The Naked Pint. Find some of her beer recommendations at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be right back with a primer on dumplings, the ultimate comfort food. Stay close. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Nothing says comfort more than a dumpling. Andrea Nguyen is the author of Asian Dumplings. She's going to give us a primer on those delicious pockets of goodness. So what do you think is the best starter dumpling for us making it at home?
Just start out with a basic dumpling dough. You probably already have the ingredients in your home. And just look in your kitchen for some regular all-purpose flour. All you need is the flour and water. And from that dough, which you can make ahead in advance and keep it refrigerated, just bring it to room temp whenever you're about to make your dumplings, and then pick a filling. If you like pot stickers, go ahead and choose something that's simple. You can have chicken, pork, or beef. Start with a really simple shape. If you're not, you know, manual dexterity isn't your thing, just make a little half moon. What you want to do is experience the art and craft of making the dough from scratch. And it's very easy. Doughs made at home from scratch, you know, you don't have to wet them to seal them up. You just pinch them together. Don't worry about looks at the beginning, folks. Just get the darn thing sealed up.
And also, we probably shouldn't worry about making them a little bigger than we may have seen them before, because it's easier to make a bigger one than a tiny one.
Exactly. You know, people, we always think that, my goodness, they have to be the perfect dumpling. But the reality is, you know, I've eaten dumplings from all over the world. And if, for those of you who remember the old Mandarin Deli when it existed down in Chinatown, Los Angeles, they had these huge pot stickers and boiled dumplings that were about 4 or 5 inches long. And you know what? They're so wonderful. And they made their dough from scratch. Make them big. And then, you know, work your way down to smaller sizes, I say.
Now, when we're using that kind of regular all-purpose flour-based dough, can we roll out the dough with a pasta maker? Or is it easy to do it with a rolling pin?
You know, a lot of Asian cooks use what are called these small little wooden dowel rolling pins. They're about 3/4 inch to 1 inch thick. And the thing, and each one of them is rolled out individually. When I started doing this book, I thought, you know what, I got to figure out a way to like make dumplings so that I can do it over and over and over again, because I practice a lot. And so what I devise is a method where you kind of get things started. And this is a very cross-cultural approach. I get things started using a Mexican tortilla press. So each one of the little nuggets of dough gets pressed in a tortilla press. And so you already have sort of like this pre-shaped round. And then you make about 5 or 6 passes using this small wooden rolling pin, which, you know what, you don't have to go down to a Chinese restaurant supply shop or houseware shop to get it. Just go to a hardware store, home improvement store, get a wooden dowel and cut it at 12 inches and sand it down. You can even use a broom handle if you want to. And then you just kind of roll it and you turn the dough as you do it. And this can be a group activity.
You're making the filling in such a way that when it's boiled, there's that wonderful slurpy liquid inside, not just the solid filling.
Exactly. And that is such an amazing, nifty little trick that the Chinese came up with around the 1880s. And so there what you've got is the soup is actually inside the skin. The dumpling is not floating in soup is what I try to tell people. And so the soup is prepared and then it's gelled. And in the past, and traditional cooks will cook up a large vat of a very thick stock. They'll throw maybe some skin in there, and then that naturally congeals. Modern cooks will use gelatins such as agar, which is a seaweed-based gelatin that's completely flavor neutral. And then you chop it up into small pieces, and then you mix that back into your meat filling. Now, the thing that's interesting about the wrapper is that it actually needs to be strong enough to hold when you pick it up. So the filling releases its liquid in the wrapper, but the wrapper will sort of expand. If you've got a steamer that has one of those glass lids, you will see the wrapper really expand like a balloon practically. And then oftentimes you'll see the juices bubbling up inside, it's boiling. And so, you know, the wrapper is prepared in such a way where it's delicate enough but elastic enough to hold its sort of like structural integrity so that you can pick it up at the end and the liquid still remains and you're at the table and you can pick it up with your chopstick or even with your fingers, okay, and then place it into your soup spoon to enjoy.
So wonderful. I can't wait to start cooking out of this book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Find a delicious recipe for dumplings at kcrw.com/goodfood. There's a video there, too, that demonstrates how to roll out the wrappers. You can podcast or download this show, find recipes, photos, and more information on all of today's guests at kcrw.com/goodfood. Sign up for my weekly newsletter there, too. And don't miss Chef Eric Greenspan's turn on KCRW's Guest DJ project. Find it on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Here's one of his music selections. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced and edited by Harriet Ells, with help from Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Candace Moyer, and Jillian Ferguson. Thanks to Darby Maloney, Gary Masiha finds all our music. I'm Evan Kleinman. I'll be right here next week for another edition of Good Food.